You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
This is Meant to Be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coral Lee. Author Nancy Hachizu is the authority on all things Japanese. Her bibliography may seem backwards to most, a kind of telescoping outwards. Her first book was specifically focused on farm food, her second on various Japanese methods of preservation, and most recently, most audaciously, her book is titled Japan the Cookbook. Nancy is proof in the pudding that another once foreign culture, cuisine, food, and mannerisms, etc., can be studied, learned, embodied, sensitively, accurately, and holistically. Thank you so much for joining me today, Nancy. So let's start. Oh, there we go. So let's start with how I typically start my interviews, with just simply, where are you from?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Great. Okay, so we're just going to start the interview but with just some background. Where are you from?
I grew up in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. Moved away from there and then went back there for college. And then in 1988, I made my way to Japan, thinking I was going to stay for a year to learn some Japanese and then go to graduate school and get a JD and a master's in East Asian studies, as in Japanese language, because I was in love with sushi and I was going to add Japanese as my next language. Doom! And I stayed for 30 years, and I'm still there. Mm-hmm.
What initially sparked that interest in Japanese cuisine? You said sushi?
Yeah, that's just a second. I'm turning off the dishwasher where I am because it's very loud.
It's okay.
In the early 80s, I was taken to I had eaten, you know, some sort of casual sushi, takeout sushi once, and then one of my friend's grandmas made country sushi roll for me, and the taste, it was more like vegetable style, I like salads or steak tartare or raw foods, and the way the tastes were so clean, and then I also was very fond of that soup we call arajiru. It's the clear fish broth that is sort of ubiquitous beyond the miso soup paradigm, and those foods were already things that I really liked. And then I went to a real sushi bar in San Francisco with a food critic friend, and I fell in love. Like the style of eating two by two pieces, and by then I was working in the front of a house in restaurants and bars, and I I really liked the fact that of talking to the sushi master as we ate, and that whole relationship, and I just became a regular, and that I followed that sushi master to the place he opened, and then I went back to Palo Alto for about a year, and I got to be friends with another sushi master, and just more than you wanted to know, but it was just, and it was not just sushi, is not just, I mean, especially, real sushi, I mean, as in the sushi bar sushi, what we call sushiya. This is way different from the sushi in the round or sushi from the supermarket or sushi make at home. It's something that people study or train for 7 years for. I mean, it's not just the food, it's the whole atmosphere. And in Japan, it's actually, I mean, a way more elevated than many places here. And I won't even, get into that right this minute, but I mean, it's about ceramics, etc. But the feeling of the place really attracted me, even though it was busy. But it's just there's something that really captured me, and that's another kind of calling point for Japan. And so I went.
And so you said your friend's mom first served you, like you said, was farm country sushi, if I remember correctly.
Grandma. College. Mm-hmm. Lived in Minneapolis, and his parents were Japanese American, and then his grandma was had come from Japan, and she made it. She had heard that I really liked it, that kind of sushi, and then she made it, and then they brought it over to the house.
And how did that sushi differ than what you might find at the sushi bar?
Oh, my God. We're talking about 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. 40.
I mean, I can recall the table we were sitting at and that sort of thing, and I can recall also when you first go or when you first taste Japanese food, especially like in America, you don't have any kind of a palate to judge it. Mm-hmm. I'm just telling you that. And when I first went to Japan, I thought everything tasted good. And now I know a lot of people go and say there's no bad food in Japan. That just is absolutely not the case. There's plenty of mediocre food and plenty of MSG in the food and plenty of very, very, very mediocre vegetables. The fish is amazing. But, I mean, there's also good food, of course. And if you compare it maybe to another big city in America, I go to New York occasionally. I know San Francisco pretty well, but I actually don't spend that much time there now. I don't spend time in big cities so much, but maybe if you compare, comparatively, it's better food in Japan, but there's plenty of bad food too. But sushi-wise, what really struck me is I tried to find the best sushi place in my town or in my city I was living when I was first there in Japan. I bumbled into somebody's house, and I was really mysterious. Every place had a curtain, you know, and a lot of people live in their shop or live above their shop and shop or restaurant. And then I found this, like, eatery, and they had, you know, they didn't have sushi, but they had big pieces of hamachi. And it was, after two or three times, I was, like, done with that place. And then I did find the best sushi shop in the city because there was a tank of fish outside, and it really had only like 10 spots at the counter, and he was very surprised to see a foreigner. Mm-hmm. And he was also surprised that I asked for something like, there's lots of tricking up of the sushi in America. I don't really have any idea what it's like now, so I'm only talking about when I was eating it in the 80s, yeah. And towards the end of the late 80s, there's a lot of like, this little dish has this and this and this in it, and this sushi has some lime and blah, 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 and this one, you know, has the ikura always has quail egg because, of course, the ikura is not very good, the salmon roe. Mm-hmm. And the quail egg mitigates the stickiness, you know. But when I asked for a quail yolk on the ikura, the salmon roe, he just looked at me in great surprise. and that reaction, I think I probably asked twice for a different, like, thinking thing. And I noticed the reaction and never asked again because I realized this is not a thing. And so really, it's about the rice, how they cook the rice, how they season the rice, and then how they treat the fish. And it's not just, we're not talking about raw fish left on the rice. There's some, I mean, if anybody's, I'm sure many people have seen Gyudon sushi, you know, the fish is rested or even aged, perhaps, and then it could be kelp wicked or vinegar wicked. I mean, vinegar treated, you know, there's all sorts of things that are happening. But it's all about that simplicity, rice and fish. And nowadays, because sushi is so expensive, you know, even in Japan, people are serving one by one because you get more variety and less price. But I can't do the one by one thing.
Yeah,
so
you mentioned
I don't go
that
to sushi very much, actually.
You mentioned being really attracted to that 2x2 or just, yeah, 2x2 eating processes. So what does that do for you compared to, you know, just the 1x1 piece?
Oh, well, 1x1, I mean, I was more referring to a big plate of food as opposed to the 2x2 thing. Mm-hmm. The 1x1 is just, forget about that. It leaves you wanting more. And then I think you're going to actually eat more. But, you know, and sometimes there was some fish that I would have one more time too of. It's more the idea of eating little by little, you know, just two little bites, and then you feel really good. And also not getting a whole board full of sushi or a whole plate full of sushi. I hate that because it should be eaten right away. Mm-hmm. You don't, like, let it pile up and I think that's probably another reason, you know, people maybe one by one makes it, the pacing is easier for people. But it's a self-paced thing for the way I order. I don't ever order, you know, the omakase thing. I guess it's a big thing in America now. But sure, I mean, if I know the guy, but in that case, we signal when I'm ready for the next thing, things like that. And mm-hmm. It's a discussion. I mean, I have been to Jiro-san's place just recently. The last time was probably the last time, and that was the first time I paid because I have friends with his editor and a very, very lucky situation and some private audiences. And so that's a whole different kind of thing, and that is one by one. It's kind of a symphony of sushi, and it's also all involved in Jiro-san as who he is as a master in his life and what he's done. And so it's like a sort of a different kind of sushi from, you know, an upscale sushi shop. And I haven't been to any of the ones in Tokyo because I still have my guy in the town. It's like 45 minutes away. I just don't go as much. It increasingly got more and more expensive. The first time was $50, and then when I brought my sister with me, it was $80. And then when my husband started coming, my husband-to-be came with me, it was like $100. And then when we got married and he moved to a new shop, very, very, very beautiful, fancy place, it became $150. Mm-hmm. And then we gained less and less, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we had kids and just forget about it because those kids eat a lot. But then I started going back because I take the train because I don't want to not have something to drink with it. So, mm-hmm.
So you grew up in Palo Alto, went to school there, and then are now in Japan. And so how, with these kind of two, but I'm guessing now you have multiple kind of home bases, how would you describe your culinary identity?
Well, actually, I was born in Palo Alto, I grew up in Atherton, and my mom was a sunset cook. And so the food we ate every day was from, and she had a whole cupboard full of Spice Islands, dried spices, shopped at the co-op. And so I grew up in the 60s, but we had a lot better food than my friends. I feel like we didn't have hamburger helper or things like that. Mm-hmm. But I was always really curious about what my friends were eating. We didn't have roasts. We had six kids in the family, and so my mom was just frugal about it. But she cooked from different countries via sunset. And that really, and we had a lot of cookbooks in the home from a lot of different countries. You know, she was, and she ended up being a professor at Dartmouth years later. So she was really she was fairly cerebral, but also she loved food, and she had grown up on a farm, so she totally didn't cook that kind of food. But so I was, you know, California. My food, what I have deep in my roots is California approach to food from 60s, 70s, and then I left in the 80s. And in the 80s, I was working in restaurants and eating out, but. So that's my roots in food, and I came back to the Bay Area because I had been in Southern California for a year when my mother was in graduate school, and that the food down there, I mean, we were shopping at Vons, and I cooked for the family that year. But I was cooking from, again, I think that it's not as much the, when we grow up the way we do, we kind of people who have no, we're like Irishy, Scotch, who knows background, you know, these mutts people with no close roots to the mother country, whatever it is. In some ways, I definitely cooked from cookbooks and magazines. I started reading Gourmet in high school, and so when I made menus for my family for that year, I cooked for them. I always cook something new mm-hmm. because I would just go and see what looks good and cook that. I wasn't thinking, I had no idea about the seasons. That's another thing in those days, nobody knew anything about seasons. So then, I went to Belgium for a year as an exchange student, and that had the impact of seeing what my mother was, the host mother was a very good cook, but really home cooking, very good cook. and Belgium, they had steak tartare with frites, French fries and mayonnaise, and salad was one of my favorite meals. And they were also loved to do a meat fondue. And I mean, I don't know, all sorts of things, but they were, it's really home cooking. And I guess that was, and that was definitely different from what my mother cooked, because she was always doing casseroles or something sunset-like. Mm-hmm. I mean, still, that's kind of my food. Either the, when I was not so young, but I was in my 30s when I was first married, I still cooked across, and I cooked with cookbooks. Paula Wolfert was a big effect, and Patricia Wells, and Elizabeth David, and I just would get, and of course Diana Kennedy for Mexican food, and Madder Jaffrey, and so I just would find an author that had gone to the country and really had gotten right deep into there, and written about it, like the women's food, probably, I guess, of the countries. And I rarely cooked from chef books, so I did cook from Wolfgang Puck, because he was friend of a friend, and so I sort of, if there's something I know about the person, it really makes the food become more alive, you know?
Mm-hmm.
For Japanese cooking was a funny kind of route. Of course, when I went there, I was thinking, I'm going to start cooking Japanese food, and I wanted to learn Japanese, and it was all sort of the same ilk. I didn't have much money when I first arrived, because you get your apartments and they have nothing in them, like nothing, not even a refrigerator. And so you have to sort of scrape that together. But I managed to, once I started getting a salary, I managed to go to sushi once or twice a month, because that was in the budget. But the food, at first I was watching TV and just doing some random egg and vegetable stir fries, which we actually never did again until this new book, because it was not farm food. It was not something that my husband ever did, you know, but it was on TV. And I bought some rice, and I bought vegetables every day, and I had some eggs, and they were probably horrible eggs, you know. And I just tried to make something Japanese-y every night. And I bought one tofu every day from the local tofu shop, because it was good tofu is just so amazing. Mm-hmm. And not anything like some of the long-term tofus that are sold here. So I have been using Hodo soy since I've been in America. I haven't used the New York one. I hear there's one there, and I use something in Chicago. But anyway, I eventually went to Tokyo, because where I was living, there was no English books, and Amazon was a thing of the future. This is in 88, and I bought a Shojin Ryori book, which was temple food, and then also a home cooking book that the Tsuji people had put out. And the Tsuji people are the people that were behind the Japanese cooking, A Simple Art. They did not write the book.
Mm-hmm.
One of my friends and somebody else at Kodansha wrote the book. And, of course, MSK Fisher was involved, but people that wrote it were different than the... And so, anyway, I was actually not so appealed... The home cooking by the Tsuji people, was not actually so appealing to me. Seemed like flat in some way, and I maybe should not say this, and I get some backlash about this, but the Zen cooking books called The Art of Zen Cuisine, I think it's also in other, they've retitled it a few times from Kodansha International, Zen Temple, blah, 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 I don't know, Temple Food, but anyway, the Art of Zen Cuisine, and it's so-called written by an abbess, but in fact it was written by my friend Kim Shufton. He's an editor. He's in his early 80s now. He lives near me. It was written by him, and he spent a day every week for a year at the abbess writing the notes for writing this book. And, you know, years later, I met him, and we became very close friends. But this book really captured me. It was just so... The words that he had written, channeling her, what she wrote was so beautiful, about concentrating on the washing of the rice. And, you know, when I was the first in Japan, I tried to do the zazen thing, and nobody even knows what zazen is in Japan, it seems like, you know. And And I mean, they know, but it's not part of people's lives, really. You know, I mean, that's a super blanket statement, but anyway. And I just felt like it was so fake for me to be sitting there, you know, doing Zazen. I was just like, oh, this is ridiculous. You know, just stop this. But the feeling of it, like the washing of the rice, I wanted to be that person who was not, like, having grown up in this wild, crazy family with six kids screaming and yelling all day long and arguing. And I wanted to be that quiet, zen-like person. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to concentrate on the rice. And, God, I bet that took probably 20 years before I really, you know, and that was through the process of cooking. And just, I like to cook alone a lot of times just because it's so quieting and just gives yourself a time to just, you know, just forget about everything and just think about, you know, the vegetables you're touching or that, you know, that just then let them just sort of find their way into however, and whether it's Western cooking or Japanese cooking, it's sort of the same. So anyway, the long and short of it is that I didn't really find any books. That Zen cuisine book was the only one that really spoke to me. And I didn't find any Japanese cookbooks that did. And so I would have dinner parties, and I started with I did the Zen cuisine and a few other things. And everybody was just so, this was when I was first there. I was just starting to accumulate a few students in the school I was working at. And then the next time I tried the Suji book with a home cooking, and it was Mizutaki, which, you know, actually I never ate again until I wrote this book. And it's a chicken nabe and kind of restaurant food, really. And then I got lots of kibitzing from my friends, one girlfriend who was kind of bossy. And then she got my husband involved. And then I was like, you know what? I should not be cooking Japanese food 2 months into my stay in Japan for my Japanese friends. This is really kind of a piece of insanity. So when my friends came over, I cooked Western food. I continued to sort of do that quasi stir fry thing for my. I actually have no clue what I was eating in that period. But and then when we got married, my husband is a good cook, and he had the Japanese part down, and he had been cooking in his family for his mom and dad for 7 years since he had gotten back from university and was living at home working with his father. And so I let that all happen because pretty soon we had starving kids, and, like, you know, division of labor in a house is, whoa, you know, it's a thing. So I cooked all the other foods, and then except for, like, salads, because Japanese salads are not really a thing. And I made up a dressing that was similar to the idea of I always made the salad dressing in our family, my sister or I, and we never measured and we never used bottles. So I just devised one with sesame oil and soy sauce and Japanese vinegar, rice vinegar, to sort of match the idea. That's still sort of perfected a measuring out thing because you need it for recipes. So that remains a dressing that pops up in the books, not in this one. I took over the tempura because I did not like a bunch of soggy tempura, which is the country style, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the country vegetable soup and all those things. I just started. David Leibovitz famously said, if you live on a Japanese farm, we were at a blogger thing and a blog camp, and if you live on a Japanese farm and then your niche is, you should write a book about, talking about niche, you should write a book about the 100 most easy Japanese country recipes. And so it was like, okay, I can't fight it anymore. Japanese cookbook coming up.
Yeah. Something really interesting with the Zen of washing rice and how you really wanted to kind of adopt that practice, but you also felt like it was just silly to just kind of co-opt, you know, just to start doing it and really champion that. And so I think that's really important to note. I don't think many chefs kind of practice that same sensitivity. And so do you think it's just a matter of time? Like you mentioned, it was like, it's finally been 20 years and you feel like you can do that now.
Yeah, because, you know, at first people can say to you, blah, 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 you know, and or listen to the vegetables. But you can try, but it's just, like, listening to the vegetables is something that I talk about. And, you know, sometimes on TV or like on in Japanese farm food, it really is, and a lot of chefs are going to the field, you know, and they're learning how to, you touch them when they're alive, whether they're, you know, greens or vegetables or herbs or blah, blah, whatever. You touch them and they give you some energy, and it does take time, and some people are faster than others. For me, it was a process. I had no idea about seasons, and it just, you know, the first time my husband-to-be brought me a bunch of God knows what, I think it was probably a hawk's eye, the Napa cabbage. I was like, what the hell am I going to do with all of this? It's filling up my whole refrigerator. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, when you have a lot of something, we eat a lot of something. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, but I don't want to have it a lot of something. And it that was a process too. But you can't just all of a sudden change and say, I try to give advice, like try to just change one thing, you know, and your audience is, you know, way closer to being there, but I'm talking about people like, you know, some, I have a little preschool, mothers in the school, they don't even, like, Japanese have this trustingness about them, which is absolutely amazing, but sometimes infuriating, but would not even read the labels to see it's got MSG and preservatives in it and all sorts of crap, and so even with little children, but, you know, like, one thing to change is, you know, not even cost as much as better olive oils as, like, soy sauce. It's, you know, maybe the top shelf is three times as much as the one that's made from defatted soybean grits, but it's, like, 10 times as good, mm-hmm. you know? And so, yeah, it's three times as much, but it's 10 times as good. Mm-hmm. So, and you lose so little, you know? It's and it's, so just changing one thing causes you to change the next and next, because your soy sauce tastes so good, then your vegetables are not so, have no taste, and then maybe you want a vegetable that tastes as good as the soy sauce. I'm just talking about a really simple preparation, and then maybe you want to have actually real katsuobushi, the smoked dried fermented fish that you got. The packaged ones are all only smoked and never dried and fermented. So then you want to get one that you're actually going to hand shave. It's a process. And with chefs who are madly using Japanese ingredients, my huge recommendation is, I understand that perhaps you can't, or home cooks that can't afford to keep buying the top shelf items. Because, yes, they are more expensive, especially the oils or the vinegars of Japanese that you've never actually seen. And I'm going to tell you, the Japanese pantry guys are the only ones bringing in the best oil in Japan, which is Wadamon, life-changing oil, sesame oil. You could throw away that crap you have in your kitchen. And the vinegar, like from Iyo Jozo, compared to Marukan and Mizukan, I mean, that should not belong in, Marukan and Mizukan shouldn't belong in anybody's kitchen. It's made from ethyl alcohol and maybe amazake, I think. I mean, barely even any rice. But the life-changing ones are available, but they're on a very small basis. And if you learn from those really amazing ones, then, okay, my restaurant can't afford to buy this. Okay, then you scale down, right? Mm-hmm. But don't learn from the crap or the mid-range, because you won't learn. And then I've tried to, sometimes when I come with the soy sauce, people or the sesame guy, I took them around to a few places in Brooklyn. There were some places that we liked and some places we didn't feel like, and of course no names are involved, that were using the product, or, you know, whether it's seven spice, which people are wrongly calling, it's chichimi tongarashi, everybody's calling tongarashi, which just means chile. So it's either seven spice or one spice, chichimi or chichimi, but people should get that right, please. But using it poorly or using it, not understanding it, and that just comes from, I think, not just using a not a good one, you know. Mm-hmm. And that actually, yes, it's extremely bothersome. It's back to you, what you talk about a lot, I think, not that I know so well, but about cultural insensitivity. It's insensitive just to blanketly use Japanese ingredients without understanding the heart. Mm-hmm. You know, I go to Japan, grab a few ingredients, and then throw them in here and there and whatever everywhere, and shiso's everything. You know, we don't use a lot of shiso, actually. You know, but I know it's a easy thing to, and some of the Australian chefs are doing that too. Just like, you can read a menu, if it has shiso more than once, then there's a problem. No, seriously. You know, just overusing. But mm-hmm. understanding the heart of somebody else's ingredients. And then you can, like, you can put miso, for instance, in, if you're making a gratin with cream, like with potato and Gruyere and some onions, miso goes really well as a back flavoring for the cream. Mm-hmm. You know, but until you really know what, and until you have good miso, I wouldn't be wildly just without any, you know, just, it doesn't make, without any logic to it or any sensitivity, just like flopping it in here and there and just, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah, so let's take
Not
a short break.
Yeah,
no, you're good. We're just going to take a short break and we'll get back to using ingredients sensitively.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sirchois was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Okay, and we're back. So we were just talking about picking the... being willing to pay maybe three times the amount for a top quality soy sauce and really learning from these much more higher quality ingredients and how that gives you more so the context or gets you at the heart of what Japanese cooking is about. But I feel like there's also the other side to this, Nancy, where it's like there's kind of this conception...
I totally missed that first part.
Oh, sure. So
there was all this music there.
Yeah, we were just recapping about how you were talking about how, like... sometimes it's worth paying a little more for soy sauce, a soy sauce that might be 10 times better than bottom shelf soy sauce, right? And so, but there's the kind of the darker side to that, or this misconception that then Japanese food is kind of hard to break into, right? There's this weird fetishization of it's just like a craft that is hard to, you know, you have to study under a master for a long time. And so where do you stand on that?
Yeah, well, you know, look at, there's restaurant food and then there's home food,
mm-hmm.
okay? And there are restaurants that, and Japanese restaurant food is very specialized in Japan. And I have noticed that in U.S. or in Australia, the only place in France or places like that, that they've got the gamut from ramen to sushi to tempura to every single kind of Japanese food you could imagine all in one restaurant, which is kind of mind-bogglingly mm-hmm. crazy.
Right.
you know, so it's kind of not, can't be good. But anyway, there's going to be the ramen shop. There is the sushi shop, sushiya. There is the tempura restaurant. And there is the yakiniku, the Korean barbecue shop. There's, you know, it's more specialized. Then there's also little eateries that are going to have the, you know, katsudon and things like that, but the fried cutlets, I mean, I don't really eat that kind of food outside. I eat ramen or over the soba shop. For me, soba shops, we say shop, you know, at the restaurants or shops. Soba shops, We happen to have a local soba shop that's one town over one way and one town over the other way. Soba Ra and Soba Ro and the chef, Kanji Nakatani, he's going to be in my next book, but we just did a dinner together at Chez Panisse, and that's his fourth one, and he's leaving today, but he was at Izakaya Rintaro in San Francisco for 3 days. And soba shops have soba, but if it's a really good one, like Kanji Nakatani's place, he makes the most incredible sashimi plate. Yeah, and so he's really good at fish. And then he also has different cooked dishes, and he has, so you can have upscale Japanese food, and I often don't order soba. And I often just order a little zensai plate, which is a little bite, and then a seafood salad that he makes for me. It's like only he makes me a different one every time, and it's not necessarily on the menu, but it has a combination of a few like delayed vegetables and some raw fish and some katsuobushi and some fruit. It's like it's really cool, great, delicious salad. But anyway, I don't ever attempt to do that at home necessarily, though I will write a book with the chef's food. I'm writing it right now, but Food Artisans of Japan. But that should not, I feel like it's wrong to just have some guy or some girl come over and say, oh, I studied ramen for 6 months, and so now I'm going to open a ramen shop. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's disrespectful. Yeah, I do. You know, I guess that's fine, but, you know, but I have a problem with it. You know, somebody who's not Japanese and just because they look Asian, they can have a sushi shop and they can, you know, roll together some rice and fish and call it a day. You know, I don't know the percentage, but a lot of the Japanese restaurants abroad are run by non-Japanese. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say the country names, but I don't want to get in trouble. I don't know how far it's far to say, but I'm not Japanese, but I live in Japan. My role is to write about Japanese food and give you the real deal and not gloss it up. Like every Japanese is not eating sweet and salty and vinegary and whatever all those proscribed tastes are that on the table. No, they're not. They're not every day eating white, black, yellow, green on the table. No, they're just trying to get food on the table. And so I'd like to give a real picture of Japan as I know it. And gosh, it's just as I know it. You know, it's not the end all, the end alls. And this is the food that I know. And this is the food, and the preserving book was the food that the preserving and pickling and makers that I know. And then this group of food is a moment in time of a couple people that I know, and then I was able to write the recipes for their food, and then I filled it out with other food that was, other recipes that were floating around that were quite dated, and I made them more authentic because it came from an era. So Japanese food is highly approachable. But don't think you're going to open up a tempura restaurant just because you can make a batch of tempura. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, the line there, you know. And don't, you know, you can make tempura at home, and there's things to do it so that you can, and making it on a small scale is, you know, you shouldn't, you know, just make a little bit because otherwise you're going to be at the stove for a while, you know. But, yeah.
Yeah, your books are incredibly popular here, and a lot of readers, whether they're foodies or not, turn to you for knowledge on all things Japanese. I think Jonathan Gold actually wrote, Nancy is the one who knows the most about Japanese things of all people. And so
that was so sweet, yeah.
And so do you think it's important to your work that you don't live in America and just write as kind of an outsider, of American cuisine and as an outsider of Japanese cuisine?
Yeah, I mean, and I'm... Something that's also important to me is I'm very well respected in Japan, mm-hmm. and so I appear on TV to talk about this kind of stuff, and And I definitely have a brand. Like, I'm very, 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 very honest. And I'm also incredibly enthusiastic about these artisanal makers. And I will go to the grave, like, shouting, I mean, their praises, because what they do, I'm going to just, like, start crying. And what they do is so amazing. And there's a real handful of the best of the best of the best. And I am so happy to be connected with them and friends with them and having visited them. And some of them have become quite close, like the Wada-san from Sesame. And he's like my new best friend. And the soy sauce and miso, Yamaki Jozo, is in my town. And we've traveled a lot together, the daughter of the soy sauce company, Mami Tani. And I'm very close with that family. And these small handful, and then there's next level too. The best of the best of the best are people who are making the most amazing product, and they're, you know, yes, of course they need to make a profit there because otherwise they will fall apart. But that the money is not their raison d'être. I mean, that's not how or why they do it. They want to make this amazing soy sauce or vinegar or it's hard to say it in English, mirin, or mikawa mirin, meeting in Iyojozo vinegar and Yamaki Jozo soy sauce, miso and wadaman, and moroi jozo fish sauce. You know, they are not only making an amazingly great product with really, really good materials, you know, there's no Japanese sesame to speak of, so he has to source outside, but he has contract farmers. But anyway, they're not only making an amazingly top quality product with these great ingredients, but they're also the packaging is so beautiful, and they as people are so beautiful, and everything they touch is so delicious that it's that 100%-ness of it, and how they operate the companies is so with such conscience that, you know, those are the people that I support.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and, you know, I have other next level down that I also support with a heart. But the people that I'll just, like, never stop talking about are those people I just mentioned. And I've probably forgotten somebody, but, you know. And that's, I forgot the question.
That's okay. I think I'm going to go back to something that you were talking about. You talk about, so for your next book, you're looking at Japanese food artisans, and I feel like that is kind of a common understanding or conception of, quote-unquote, the Japanese, right? Like, if the Japanese try something or they work on something, they're going to perfect it. For example, like Japanese scotch most recently. And so where did this kind of practice originate, and why? I feel like there's still somewhat of a problematic stigma there.
Yeah, well, the country itself, there is such a strong work ethic. And so, it's a country has a long history of, it's been agrarian for a long time, but the artisans, like the basket makers and the ceramic makers and the box makers and all those types of artisans, such, and even the fish sauce makers, you know, all the artisanal food and the artisanal the things makers, they just respect the materials and they respect doing a job well, and that's something that's so deeply, deeply, deeply rooted in Japanese culture and still actually is there today, even though, you know, young people, some are kind of drone-like because, you know, they've gone through the school system and, you know, just like doing a perfunctory, but they still do a good job, I feel, by and large. I mean, I have heard that it's much harder to get apprentices, and they cry and, you know, they don't have the backbone. They don't have the, and that's true, you know, but there's also, you know, there's the thing of after the war, World War II, is the big companies came. And so, and there's some very large-scale food production happening in Japan, well, for a small country, you know. And so the big companies making these big brands that you get in America or overseas, other overseas countries. I did visit one, the biggest miso company recently, and it's personally, I found it kind of horrifying in that they do a really good job for a safe product that is within the realm of it's, you know, basically you could say it's well made for what it is, but the cacophony of the process, like it's so, so loud and so fast, and so I kept feeling like, oh my God, it's putting all this like loud, almost angry energy into the miso. It really freaks me out. Mm-hmm. But whereas at Yamaki, my local place, the miso's sleeping in the sleeping happily in the wooden, those huge wooden barrels, and I was like, it's such a different thing. And I didn't say anything particular, but the difference, and that's what I write about. You know, these are processes that are really quiet and gentle processes until they become industrialized. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, there's those industrial ones. You know, sure, they're well made for what they are, for the ingredients. Yeah, they're. I'm not going to use them, but you know, they're safe and they're well made. But for what they are is the caveat. Mm-hmm. You know, and the lowest level, all of the supermarket in America, we probably grew up in my family using that brand and didn't know any better. But then when, you know, my brother-in-law is making this beautiful olive oil in California, which I use in events called Frontoyo Grove, and it's like, you know, it's like a whole different thing. I think that's a no-brainer, you know. And like sesame is like coffee, you know, the roaster is the important person in the process, as well as the farmer, sure. But if you don't have... if you just have like a whatever roastery who's like burning the seeds and then putting it out in the rock gut sesame oil, then I don't know. What's the point in using it? Mm-hmm. My feeling.
Yeah. And so do you think the sensitivity to the whole process, like you were even talking about noticing that the machines are putting out angry energy into the air, like, do you think this is something that's unique to Japanese culture, or is it just kind of symptomatic of like good artisanry?
Oh, I think it is good artisanry. I mean, of course, you know, at the sesame company, because they use a lot of machines, it is a bit loud. Mm-hmm. So I'm probably being when you're pre-biased and like prejudiced against the big music company. That's probably mean. You know, I'll stop that. But a lot of these artisanal processes. And sesame, of course, was made much more quietly in the past, you know. But it takes a lot to get oil out of seeds or about out of rape blossoms or whatever they are that they take it out of. But gets out only a little. But a lot of these artisanal processes, and that's something I also mentioned, why I wrote the historical chapter and I wrote in the intro that, you know, these processes have been around for, like, the way to make miso now, I think it's been around for 1,000 years from Muromachi, and the miso soup method is from Muromachi, which is, you know, I don't have all this memorized, but it's about 1,000 years old. And so that history, it's kind of, I mean, for as an born in America person without any close ties to a home country, I just find that so, I mean, it just kind of drops you to your knees to think that this simple process, and it's still so delicious, and why, and it's so simple, so why the hell are these guys making miso in, and I'm going to get backlash for this probably, in summer when it's supposed to be made in winter, and why are they using all these frigging weird ingredients to make this weird stuff that, you know, maybe if it's delicious and it's like not called miso, but these experimental weird misos are... do bother me, and I've only tasted a couple and not found them, or weird soy sauce, I've not found them to be any redeeming quality.
Mm-hmm. And so do you think just a matter of the language around that is enough in making that quote-unquote okay for you? Or like, how would, if, you know, someone were to come out with like a pistachio nut miso, how would you enjoy that?
I'm not even interested. Mm-hmm. Could not even be. There we do have a guy. There is a place called, there's an island called Amami Oshima. It's the island that's just the southernmost island before Okinawa, and they made a thing called nutty miso. It's a cycad. Not really. It looks kind of like a chestnut, but it's not. And they make a powder from it. Hmm. And I was going to, I might put it in the next book. And I would use chestnuts and chestnut powder. It's not the same taste, but in that case, they and this old guy who moved away and is coming back. He has this little project, and he's making miso, making nutty miso, and it's basically a miso with, when he's making the rice koji, he's got the he's putting the koji on rice plus these nutty cycads. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a weird, that I can go that far, but I don't know, I'm fairly a traditionalist, and so, and hey, I'm not 30-year-old, you know. I do believe there's something to be said for the traditionalness in pickling and preserving, and so that's just my personal thing.
No, okay. Definitely, especially,
you know,
in
be against it, and that's okay.
Yeah, no, in New York or in Brooklyn, all like on every single menu, it's like, oh, quick miso, or you know, shiso jelly, you know, like just these kind of casual drops of
yeah. Unless it's, I mean, like on the island, they're gonna put, they do make a pork miso. Mm-hmm. They salt the pork and then they put it in the miso, and there are things that's not, I mean, that's not something that's not off the radar of what, you know, pistachio nut miso, or, you know, was not a big fan of the green pea miso that I tasted, you know, but because mm-hmm. It was not miso-like and it wasn't tasty.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, sure, if, you know.
Yeah, I think, like, the kind of lazy reasoning for it is that Japanese cuisine is often about technique, and so if you use Japanese techniques, but maybe with different ingredients, you're still approaching it with that same kind
of... I understand that, yeah. But in fact, like, it's totally losing the heart of the whole thing. Like, mm-hmm. you would never make a jar of miso, I'm just telling you. And I see photos online of, you know, like, these little experimental potions, and mm-hmm. a jar is just laughable. Mm-hmm. You need to make, you know, several kilos. But when you're experimenting, you're not going to make several kilos. So it's just the whole approach for me seems just a little bit off kilter.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to get in trouble from a few people that I already know.
I think it's totally valid. But just, so then what would you prescribe? How would, if I were to experiment with just one jar of miso, there's no way?
Well, if you want to do it, it's up to you. I mean, I think it's just, I don't know. For me, there's something so beautiful in the fact that you steam up some soybeans and you know, I don't even make my koji. And actually, I didn't make miso the last 2 years. I was so busy with that Fiden book with 400 recipes,
mm-hmm.
you know. But if you steam up a bunch of soybeans and then you add in rice koji, and then, in fact, I think you should, if you can get a good rice koji or barley koji, you know, that's something that it makes or breaks whatever you're making. Mm-hmm. And so that's an experiment in and of itself, you know. But so you can get good rice barley koji from Mitoku, I know, and I'm sure there's a few other places for the rice koji. But then you add it to the steamed soybeans with some, you know, good salt. I try to use good salt. And then the fact that it just will turn into this delicious miso with not much effort, just that, and then, you know, there's a little bit more involved, but not much, and it just happily turns that way by itself.
Mm-hmm.
This, to me, is like a magic miracle, but that's my feeling. You know, what you do at your house, I'm not going to go into your kitchen, but get rid of the Marukan Mizukan and that horrible sesame oil, please. Because mm-hmm. those have no redeeming factors, you know, for Japanese food for sure.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking with author Nancy Hachizu. Look out for her forthcoming book from Hardy Grant, Food Artisans of Japan. Thank you so much for joining me today, Nancy.
Thank you, girl. Okay.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.